Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 30th episode of Left of Skeptic. My name is Brittany Lind.
And I am Kayla Moria.
And we are a paranormal podcast, and it's our 30th episode.
Yes, we are, and yes, it is.
Can you believe it?
No.
30 weeks. 30 weeks of this.
We are dedicated.
Are you sick of me yet?
No. But I wasn't sick of you before. I didn't think that once, like, talking to you once a week was going to make me sick of you anyway, so.
That's true. How are you doing this week?
I am awesome. I just got back from the beach. It was my niece's birthday party.
Fun.
So.
Fun.
We hung out. I went into Lake Superior, ruined my straightened hair. I also got a haircut.
Nice. I thought you looked a little bit different.
You can see here. The listeners can't, so maybe I'll post a picture of it later. I don't know. We'll see if I'm feeling cute. But between the new haircut with the backwards cap and the button-up shirt that I was wearing for the, like, beach party and all this, I basically look like a 13-year-old gamer.
Yeah, but it looks fantastic, though, so... You look cute, girl.
Thank you. Otherwise, just living my life and getting ready for the school that starts next week. So
that's it's the end of August.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's what I was saying.
How did that happen?
Summer is slipping away. I've only been in the lake twice this year. This is insanity.
I'm not sure if I have been at all.
Oh, we should go to the beach at some point. We'll have to carve out a night to just go down there anyway.
I agree.
How have you been?
100%. Pretty good. This last week was my birthday week.
Yes.
So I got to go hang out with the Crunchy Bunch at Earthrider, which was super fun. If you don't know the ins and outs of the Duluth music art scene, Al LeBlanc, who created our logo, is one of the members of the Crunchy Bunch, though he currently lives in Chicago. So his brother, Chris, was actually the one who was DJing during my birthday hangout. Steve gave me this really awesome, I don't know if you can see it behind me, it's a Stay Sexy, Don't Get Murdered sign, because he knows me really well. And then my whiskey club, which I'm not sure if I've talked about on the podcast before, I do a monthly whiskey club, and there's 9 of us, and we pick a bottle that's something that we wouldn't normally buy ourselves, because they're pretty expensive, but if you split it up 9 ways, it's much more reasonable. So it just so happens that Karen Sunderman, who is kind of a local celebrity in Duluth, her birthday is also in August. So we decided that we were just going to do something a little bit different for Whiskey Club this month, actually. And we hired Jerry Small to come serenade our group of 9 people in Karen Sunderman's backyard. And she just sang to us while we drank whiskey and, like, hung out and then had snacks. And it was fantastic.
That's so beautiful.
Right? I know. It was just the greatest thing ever.
Plus, Jerry Small is just so nice. And
so nice.
All the people from Crunchy Bunch are just beautiful people. You just had a lot of great musical people around you.
So many. And yeah. And then Kayla, on Friday, it was the Electric Fetus reunion. So the Electric Fetus is a record store that has existed on Superior Street in Duluth for the last 30 years, actually over 30, 33 years. And it closed its doors when the pandemic happened, and then it just never opened them again. So there was a group of people ranging from the very beginning 30 years ago up until the most recent batch of employees, and we all had a little mini reunion.
Cute.
It was super cute.
I like that a lot. We got to start wearing masks again, so I'm fully prepared to not see people anymore, except for, like, you in this format for a while. Nah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking about during the entire week. The fact that this is probably the last time that I'm going to do a lot of these things or see a lot of these people in person. And so
I just want to scream at the world, listen, world. I got 4 months left of school. I want this shit under control by the end of these 4 months so that I can celebrate. Not to make this all about me, but I'm making it about me.
No, that's legit. I mean, I will if this is done in 4 months, I will also be celebrating not only you, but everything else. So, yeah. Come on, let's do it. We can do it, guys.
We can do it. We can do it. I want a Halloween. I want a Halloween.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. It's fine. I think that we should get started because I know that we both have some good stories here this evening. So should we hit everything off with a word from our sponsors?
Let's do it.
Brittany, I just got back from the beach.
Oh, yeah? How was it?
It was gorgeous. I'm going to be grasping at the last traces of summer these next few weeks, especially now that school is starting. One way I keep doing that is to enjoy a nice summer beer, so I took some Tap Shack with me.
Nice.
Earth Riders Tap Shack is a Caribbean-style lager. It's light, refreshing, and brewed with a touch of lime zest to deliver good vibes anytime.
I feel that for sure. One of my favorite summertime beers is the Cloud Top Hazy IPA, which is what I'm drinking tonight, actually. It's got hints of orange, pineapple, and mango, which makes this IPA super juicy and perfect for the warm summer evenings.
For more information on Earth Rider beer and where you can find it, visit earthrider.beer.
And we're back.
Ooh, that was a very gentle, and we're back.
I'm practicing my NPR voice.
Of course.
Also, I seem to be losing my voice, so I apologize.
You sound beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. And I gotta say, I'm so intrigued by the very little bit of information you gave me about your story. It was so vague and very confusing. And so I'm so excited to finally hear about it. I read it to Steve and I went, I don't know what this is, but I bet it's gonna be good.
So my subject this week isn't a cryptid and it isn't a location. I decided to go with something a little different, which is exactly what I messaged Brittany. That's it. That's all the information she had.
Yeah, what does that mean?
So let me start out by saying this is the most legitimately researched story I have done since we started this podcast in January. And by legitimately, what? I mean that if I had the right class, I could easily write an A-grade paper with the resources I found while doing this research.
What? Okay, I need to know what this is.
These sources are all, every single one of them, are relevant, peer-reviewed, scholarly journals published through legitimate universities such as the Indiana University and the University of Missouri. They would all easily qualify as valid sources in any college class.
Well, huh.
I had the idea for this, and I just decided to Google it on my school's library research page and came up with a ton of stuff. So I was like, holy crap, there are a lot of studies on this subject, probably because it is arguably one of the best known legends around the world, one of the most famous ghosts. Today I'm going to be talking about the Vanishing Hitchhiker.
I was immediately, when you said famous ghost, I was thinking like Bloody Mary, what? But no, the Vanishing Hitchhiker. What? Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm ready. Tell me a story, Kayla.
Setting the scene.
Okay.
Your favorite music blares from the speakers of your car as you drive down a dark wooded road. It's late at night and you're tired and you just want to get back to your house. Suddenly, a woman in a flowing white dress appears on the side of the road, illuminated by the beam of your headlights. You slow to a stop, roll down your window, and ask her if she's okay. The woman simply continues to stare at you. The stare leaves you slightly nervous, but she's out here with no coat and it's getting cold. You ask her if she needs a ride, to which she responds, "Take me home?" She hops in on the passenger side and you can get a better look at her. She's young, maybe in her 20s. Her skin is pale, her eyes look sunken like she hadn't slept well the night before, and her dress is thin. Not much for protection, and it's a bit tattered. But it's October, this is not necessarily out of the ordinary, so you try to start up a conversation, hoping to break the ice by saying something like, "Are you coming from a costume party or something?" She remains silent, only indicating when you need to take turns to get her back to her home. Sometime later, she has you pull up into an overgrown driveway. As you pull up, you catch your first view of the house. It's boarded up windows and dilapidated porch. The paint is peeling, and it's dark, so you can't fully tell, but you're pretty sure the roof is collapsed on the back right corner. "Come on, you don't live here," you ask. She looks at the house longingly and says, "I can never go home." "What are you talking about? Nobody even lives here," you say, staring up at the house. You are no longer able to hide the frustration in your voice. She might have thought this was funny, but it's not. You really wanted to help her out, but it's late and you had just come off of a 12-hour shift. Turning back to her, "Where do you really live?" She's no longer in the car. "Hello?" You get out of the car and look around. "Joke's over, okay? You want me to leave you here or something? I really need to get home now." You walk around the car, still no sign of her. Up to the house, you look through the broken screen door, but don't dare go in any further that direction. The whole thing might collapse. Anyway, there were no tracks in the dust and dirt that indicated the woman would have gone in that way. So you walk around the back of the house. You can see that the roof is, indeed, collapsed. Black scorch marks line the walls. You find an open doorway into what looks like a kitchen. You take one tentative step in, shouting for the woman to come out, and the floorboards creak under your feet. Something in the corner catches your eye, and you pick it up. It's paper. A photograph. In it is a beautiful woman in a white sundress, the same woman who was just in your car. Written on the back is the words Rebecca, 1964. So the tales vary depending on the years and region, but the basis of the story always remains the same. A traveler picks up a vulnerable-looking person on the side of the road and offers them a ride, only to have that passenger disappear without a trace sometime later. Soon, after some form of investigation or random chance of given information, the traveler learns that the hitchhiker was a ghost or some form of supernatural entity.
That is the beginning of the first episode of Supernatural.
I know. I'm getting
there. I love it.
I'm getting there. The legend was given its well-known name, well-known now, of the vanishing hitchhiker in 1942 by Richard Beardsley and Rosalie Hankey in a journal called the California Folklore Quarterly, published by the Western States Folklore Society. It became even more famous as the title story in Jan Brunvald's The Vanishing Hitchhiker, American Urban Legends and Their Meanings in 1981. You've never gone camping and heard the story around a fire? You don't spend your time randomly searching for urban legend journals in your school's library website. You're thinking, hey, left of skeptic, I'm a modern person. You're talking about things that happened over 40 years ago. Chances are you've still heard of it. It was actually the subject for the first episode of the popular television series Supernatural, and has been the subject of many other spooky television shows, movies, and books. After I researched this, Netflix or one of those sites, just recommended that I watch The Hitcher, which came out in, I want to say, 2013 and is based on this. Like, there's tons of different scary things based around this legend. Hankey and Beardsley found that there are four main variants of this story. Variant A, the hitchhiker gives an address, and after vanishing, the hitchhiker leaves behind something. A scarf, a book, a coat, etc. And this is used as proof when the motorist talks to a police officer or someone at an address that they were really in the car. Later, the motorist is able to identify the ghost by a picture of the deceased one in the house at the address, oftentimes wearing or carrying whatever they left in their car. Variant B, the hitchhiker is some sort of a prophet-like figure. They appear in the car and foretell some sort of tragedy or grand event. Later, the driver discovers that the hitchhiker has died, and then shortly after learns that whatever event they predicted comes true. Variant C, the hitchhiker is described as a young woman, almost exclusively in this variant, who is picked up outside of some place of entertainment like a club or a party and taken home in the car. Proof is later found when something noticeable the woman was wearing, such as a coat or a scarf, is found on top of her gravestone. And variant D, which is the least common variant, where the hitchhiker is some kind of a local deity. This one is prominent in Hawaii, where locals tell tales of the vanishing hitchhiker being Pele, who is a goddess of volcanoes. According to John William Johnson of Indiana University, the first possible variant of the legend is actually occurring in the Bible.
What?
Yeah. Y'all, seriously, I looked at a Bible for this story.
Where'd you find one?
I still have one.
Oh, okay.
I was, like, super Catholic. Like, super Catholic in, like, junior high.
It feels a little weird to throw away Bibles, too.
Yeah, right? And it just feels like bad juju. Even if you don't believe it, mine. Plus, it's full of, like, some interesting stories, such as the one I'm about to tell you. Keep in mind, this is my interpretation of the story. This is not the way it's written in the Bible. All right, you ready?
I don't know what that means, but I'm excited because you already think it's funny, so I know it's got to be good.
In the book of Acts, chapter 8, verses 26 to 40, there is the story of Philip and the Ethiopian. I'm not going to read it to you fully, partially because I want to spare you and partially because I want to spare me. But in summary, the Lord said to Philip, get your ass out of bed and go south on this wilderness road to Gaza. So Philip goes, right?
Uh-huh.
He runs into an Ethiopian eunuch. Why is the fact that he's a eunuch relevant? I don't know. But his castration status, like, keeps coming up. They really just, you never learn his name. They just keep calling him the eunuch.
The eunuch? Mm.
This dude is traveling and reading the prophet Isaiah. And the Lord is like, yo, Philip, go over to that guy's chariot and join him. And so Philip does. Philip asks him if he understands what he's reading, and the eunuch is like, how can I understand? Because nobody will explain it to me. Help me. And so he invites Philip into the chariot with him. So they're traveling, and they're reading, and they're talking. And Philip is all like, hell yeah, Jesus. And the eunuch is like, yeah, no, totally. Hell yeah, Jesus. I can get behind that. And so they're traveling and continuing to talk about it, and they're both like super jazzed. And then they come upon some water, like a lake or a river or something, and the eunuch is like, you could totally baptize me here. And so they go for a dip. Philip baptizes the eunuch, and then God's like, yo, we gotta leave, and snatches Philip away, just no warning, nothing. And the eunuch is just like, where the fuck did you go? But it was cool because he was still super jazzed about, like, learning about God. So he went about his way spreading the word of God. The end of the story.
And now he's baptized. Great.
So, in this instance, Philip is the vanishing hitchhiker. This narrative, well, not this exact narrative, but you get what I mean, is said by some to be the oldest known tale of the legend of the vanishing hitchhiker.
I mean, the Bible's pretty old, so yeah.
John William Johnson, who is where I found this story, wrote the journal article, The Vanishing Hitchhiker in Africa. And that's where I found this. And he gave a lecture to students at the Somali National University in 1987. He spoke on several topics, including the vanishing hitchhiker. After his lecture, a student came up to him and told him, quote, a story that could not be a legend as I had defined it, because it had actually happened in Somalia some years before. The story goes, Ali went to study for his BA in the United States. He had a girlfriend back home in the Somali Democratic Republic, and he wrote to her regularly, and she to him. He was in the States for 4 years, and finally finished his studies and took his degree, so he returned home on an airplane. His girlfriend, Fadumo, met him at the airport, and they were obviously very happy to see each other after such a long time. They spent the whole day together, and in the evening they went to a hotel's nightclub. When it got very late, Ali walked Fadumo home along the beach where it was a bit cold, so Ali gave her his jacket, which she draped across her shoulders. After getting her home safely, he started home himself, realizing partway there that he had forgotten to get his jacket back, but he was like, no matter, I'll just get it in the morning. The next morning, he went to Fadumo's house where he was greeted by her father and the rest of their family. After a while of chatting, Ellie asked Faduma's father where she was, thinking she just slept late because they were out at the club the night before.
Right.
Oh, Ali, Faduma's father sighed. I have very bad news. Faduma was killed in a car crash 2 years ago. I'm sorry to greet you with such sad tidings. Impossible. We went to the club last night. I have her letters from the past 4 years. Ali was inconsolable. So Vadumo's father took him to the cemetery so he could visit her grave and prove to him that she had passed on. Ali agreed and quietly sat in the car as they drove up the hill to the cemetery. When they arrived at Fadumo's grave, they were astounded to find Ali's coat sitting on top of her gravestone.
But who was writing him letters?
Right? Although the story was reconstructed and Johnson used fake names, he assured the readers in his scholarly article that the student did give him specific names when telling the story, and the narrative named several real places: the airport, the hotel nightclub, the beach, and the cemetery. All of those lended validation to the story that he had been told and made him feel comfortable to publish it.
That is what?
Yeah. In a 1998 article published in Western Folklore, Jillian Bennett argued that while these stories have a lot of commonalities, the variants listed by Hankey and Beardsley are too restrictive. In the, at the time, 55 years of study on this archetype, because obviously it was 98, so it's been a lot longer now.
Right.
The hitchhiker is usually a younger woman, but there are a whole host of studies where the hitchhiker is a young man, one recorded where it was an old man, and a handful of stories where it was an elderly woman. Nowadays, when the stories are told, the way people died isn't necessarily specified, but when it is, it's usually some form of an accidental death. Most are vehicle crashes, like the story of Ali and Fadumo. But in a number of stories, the hitchhiker is the ghost of someone who was killed while walking on a road to go to a party or visit a relative. Some stories mix the two and say that it's the ghost of a woman who was thrown out of a car by a jealous lover and died after getting hit by that car or froze to death while walking. Elsewhere, the story becomes of a person who had been murdered or a victim of a distressful death. There was a sick girl dies in a house fire. Another person dies from carbon monoxide poisoning. A man is stuffed into a barrel and rolled down a hill on the road. An old lady is cemented into a barn floor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I could tell these stories for hours. The only tie-in seems to be that the hitchhikers are always random, innocent victims.
Mm-hmm.
Beardsley tells the story that he found in 1940 in New York, where a man and his wife were driving home from a party late in the evening. The road was dark and deserted. Suddenly, in the beam of the light from the headlights, they saw a girl standing on the side of the road, a suitcase in one hand and her coat in another. Being fearful for the girl's safety, they stopped the car and insisted that she ride with them. Without a word, she got into the car and they rode on. Very few words were spoken. They rode in silence for about a half an hour. The man, to break the silence, turned to her and asked where she lived so that they could take her home. But she had disappeared. Only her suitcase and her coat remained. The man swore he was driving 35 to 40 miles per hour, so she could not have just jumped out. On the suitcase was an address, so they went to the home and met an elderly woman of about 60 years of age. They explained what happened, and the old woman told them that they were the 10th people who had brought her a suitcase and a coat. She then took them inside the house and showed them the previous 9 suitcases and coats of the same design that she had stowed away in a closet. She told them that the girl was her daughter, who had passed away a long time ago at the age of 16.
Girl, I love these stories. And it's not until you started talking about it that I realized that I've heard so many different of this exact story.
And this story is relevant because not only is it a vanishing hitchhiker story, but it's one of the few recorded versions where there are 2 witnesses to the disappearance. It's not just
somebody making it up
to tell a tale. The wife from this tale was committed not long after this instance, and the man's mental health did not fare well either.
Well, not everyone is prepared to see a ghost.
Yeah. Another story was published by Gerald Hurley in 1952, and he said that this tale was told to him by his brother. So it's not a direct account, but it was a person they knew.
Okay.
His brother said, "I was driving from Rochester to New York City through the foothills of the Catskills. I was alone. It was a rainy night and late. Driving slowly because of the heavy rain, I noticed a figure walking on the side of the road. As I drove closer, the beam of the headlights revealed a little old lady. I stopped and offered her a ride, which she seemed to gladly accept, probably because of the rain. She said that she was going to her son's house about 2 miles up the road. For some reason, she sat in the back seat of the car, and she was very quiet. I was tired, neither of us talked. I soon reached the house that she had described, and when I turned to speak to her, she wasn't there. I was upset. I thought she might have fallen out the back door, which was the only reason I could think about for her disappearance. I immediately turned the car around and drove up and down the 2 mile stretch of road as far as to the little churchyard where I had first spotted and picked her up. There was no sign of her. I turned the car around and went back to the house she had asked to be taken to. There, I rang the bell. A man opened the door, and I explained what had happened. I said that, although improbably, the woman must have fallen out of the car. Did he want me to help look for her? He smiled gently and said not to worry. The little old lady was indeed his mother, and she was just trying to return home. Other people had come to him with the same story in the last month or so. You see, he explained, his mother had died 2 months ago and had been buried in the graveyard of the little church 2 miles down the road.
Oh, that's so sad.
Well, Mom just wanted to see her son again.
I know, but she can never make it all the way home. That's the sad part.
Well, stories from the 40s and 50s are pretty common and easy to find. Even if I didn't have my college access, I could still find a lot of these available through free journals. People are still telling similar stories in today's modern society, just not as frequent.
Well, people don't really pick up hitchhikers the way that they used to.
In a 2016 article for the 14 Times, we're told of several instances that happened in Japan after a national tragedy. And another disclaimer, bear with me if my pronunciation is terrible. At least 7 taxi drivers in Ishinomaki, Northeast Japan, have reported experiencing a phantom fare in the wake of the devastating 2011 tsunami and earthquake, according to the Asahi Shimbun newspaper. The 9-magnitude quake, the most powerful ever recorded in Japan and the 4th most powerful recorded in the world, lasted for 6 minutes and triggered a tsunami that in places reached 133 feet high and traveled 6 miles inland. I remember this. I don't know if you do.
I remember this too. Yeah.
Destroying thousands of homes and other buildings. An official report confirmed that 15,893 people had been killed. More than 6,000 more were injured, and some people are still missing to this day because they never found their bodies. They don't know where they went.
That's so sad.
Ishinomaki, a coastal town in the Miyagi Prefecture, was among the regions that was most seriously affected by the tsunami. Speaking to Yuka Kato, a student of sociology at the Tohoku Gakuin University, one taxi driver in his 50s related how he may have encountered one of these dead residents just months after the disaster. He was working in a town when a young woman dressed in a coat climbed into his cab near Ishinomaki Station and told him, please go to a district that I'm not even going to try to pronounce. He told her that the area was almost empty and asked her if he was sure she wished to go there. The woman replied in a trembling voice, have I died? The driver said he then turned around and discovered that no one was there.
Oh, no.
Another driver said a man in his 20s climbed into his taxi, and when he looked in the rearview mirror, his passenger was pointing towards the front. The driver, who was in his 40s, repeatedly asked the man for his destination, and eventually the latter said, Hiroyama, which is a mountain area. The driver set off, but when he eventually pulled over, he found the passenger had disappeared. These haunting accounts and 5 other similar ones were collected by Kudo as a part of her graduation thesis. She asked more than 100 drivers if they had experienced anything unusual in the wake of the earthquake. The question strangely sparked anger among some of the cabbies, while others pretended to not hear her, but a few were willing to talk.
All right, so that leads me to believe that more than that actually did experience it, and they just didn't want to talk about it.
And I know that many parts of Japanese culture interact with ghosts differently than we do. So I don't know. You don't know where these people are coming from. They might not be able to talk about it.
Right.
Kudo said that her research suggests that 7 drivers believe they were picking up genuine passengers because they each started their meters And as a result, the drivers were forced to pay the fares from these vanishing hitchhikers.
Oh, no.
Some jotted down their experiences in their logs. One showed us his driver's report, which noted that there was a fare that went unpaid. Several noted that the ghosts were young. Young people feel a strong chagrin at their deaths when they cannot meet the people they love, said Kudo. As they want to convey this bitterness, they may have chosen taxis, which are like private rooms, as a medium to do so. What impressed Kudo was that the drivers had no fear of their spectral passengers, but held them in reverence. They regarded the encounters as important experiences to be cherished. One said that he had lost a family member in the disaster, and another said he would willingly accept a ghost as a customer again.
Aww.
Nowadays, the legend of the vanishing hitchhiker seems to be just that, a legend. But was this really just a common story told by people in the 30s through the 50s, and then Japan just happened to pick up on it? Or is it just because it's less and less common with age because, you know, you shouldn't pick up hitchhikers?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the stories from 2011 from those cabbies in my brain of all these stories are honestly the most convincing. It's right after a national tragedy. It's unexpected. It would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but I will say that the next time that I see someone on the side of the road, that tiny little voice in the back of the head that tells me that I should stop and help will definitely shut up now.
I often have that little voice, and then I remember how many serial killers in the 60s, 70s, and 80s murdered people who were hitchhikers, and vice versa. So I don't do that. But yeah.
I've only ever picked up a hitchhiker once, and it was somebody that I knew. They happened to be hitchhiking, and I was like, all right, well, I can take you like 30 miles. By the way, I don't love that you're doing this, but you do you, boo. At least right. I'm getting you 30 more miles away, and I know you, and I know that I'm not going to kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Girl, I loved that. That was so good.
I'm glad
I was so
it.
Quiet during it because I was just sitting here like, tell me more. Tell me more.
I was excited to try something different. I mean, I love cryptids and I love locations, but this was pretty cool.
No, that was really awesome. Like I said, it wasn't until you started talking about it that I realized how many of those stories I've actually heard before.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't even dawn on me.
And that's another thing I'm thinking is how many stories are not published that we've heard? And yeah, like they're campfire stories, but it's too frequent. And the fact that it's in scholarly journals really does it for me.
Right. Yes.
So
people have like done research on it.
Yes. On a skeptic scale, para to normal, para being 5, normal being 1, what are you going to give it?
5.
I was going to give it a 5, too.
You know, it's really funny. Just a couple of days ago, I was scrolling through Facebook, and there was a meme that said, you know a man is a true ally if he's willing to allow you to give his phone number out to creepy guys at the bar, and then when they call him, he responds with, why are you calling? She died a year ago last night. So this is a really well-timed thing in regards to my social media and then my podcast.
It's not the vanishing hitchhiker. It's the vanishing bar patron. But really, she's just not into you.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I love that. That was fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, it's I'm feeling really confident about school coming up now after doing all this research. I was like, yeah, I remember how to do this. We're good. We're ready to go.
You've been doing it the whole time.
Yep.
All summer long. Well, we should probably get a word in for our sponsors, and then I have a story for you.
Hell yeah, let's do it.
Yo, there are so many amazing events happening at the Earthrider Brewery Festival grounds in the next few weeks. I personally am so excited about the Northbound Caravan event.
That's coming up this weekend, right?
It is. It's happening Friday, August 20th and Saturday, August 21st. And the lineup for this event is incredible. Of course, there's the slamming doors, but there's also Superior Siren and Lanou, both of whom recently came out with brand new albums, the Von Tramps, who are a kick-ass group from Minneapolis, and then there's Dirty Horse and the Plot Hounds. Just to name a couple of them, it's going to be a blast. And for more information about the lineup and the ticket prices, check out Earthrider's website at earthrider.beer.
And while you're there, you should look up Earthrider Fest. That's happening on September 11th, also at the festival grounds. You can see Charlie Parr, Turn, 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 the Polk Aerobics. There's a stein-holding competition, keg toss, yeah, and crowd-eating contest. There are featured beers and special beer releases. It's just a great end of the summer party. There are only 350 advance tickets being sold, so head over to earthrider.beer to get yours now.
And don't forget to check out the other events that are happening at the Earthrider Brewery Festival Grounds or in their Cedar Lounge tap room by following them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Earthrider Beer.
And we're back.
Yeah.
I used my MC voice for that because when I hosted the Proctor Pistons pinup contest, I got...
Oh, yeah, I forgot to ask you how that went.
I got three compliments from very nice Proctor residents and not people that I would initially think would come up and compliment me.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be clear. I love people until they give me a reason not to love them. But generally, right, Proctor is not an area where a woman who dresses like I do would think they're going to get compliments.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I got three different people that came up to me and they're like, you have the perfect voice for this. Like, that was great. And I was like, oh, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Oh. So that was a I got a song. Face for radio.
Same.
Well, what do you got for me?
Tonight, I'm taking you back to Cleveland.
Ohio! Isn't there a show that had a theme song? All the little chicks with the crimson lips go Cleveland rocks. Cleveland rock. Drew Carey. It was a Drew Carey show.
I was going to say, isn't that the Drew Carey show?
Yep. So yeah. I have two things that Cleveland makes me think of. Hawthorne Heights or the Drew Carey show.
When the first time I went to Ohio and you sang Hawthorne Heights, I was expecting you to do Drew Carey show.
I got to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, I love that. That's what this is. It's just you keeping me on my toes and then me saying things that encourage you to keep me on my toes.
Fuck yeah, bud.
Clearly, I'm not on my toes right now.
It's okay. It's late.
It's late. It's later than we normally record. So.
But I've had almost no exhaust noise in the background.
That's awesome.
Like, I don't know if you noticed how little I had to pause in that last story, but...
It was very little. Yeah. I liked it. All right, so tonight I'm going to tell you about the Franklin Castle. And I had a really hard time with starting this one because I kept reading it and going, did we already do this? And then I looked at the list and I was like, I don't see it. And then I'd read a little bit more and I'm like, no, but did we already do this? and then I do like control F and type in a couple of things. I'm like, but seriously, did we already do this?
We did and not I no do idea. This. I can tell you that we absolutely did not do this.
Yeah. Once it got further down in the story, I'm like, okay.
Well, I just looked through all of our.
I don't remember any of this.
I just looked through all of our episode lists recently when I was going through and showing somebody. So I read the descriptions and everything too.
Okay.
And I know that we did not do this.
Yeah. All right. So the Franklin Castle is a Victorian style home that was built on Franklin Boulevard in Cleveland, Ohio. Franklin Castle, also referred to as the Tiedemann House, was built in 1881 through 1883 for Hannes Tiedemann, who is a German immigrant, grocer, and investment banker. And I know that I've had a story that had a German immigrant who was a grocer who then turned businessman in the past. And I think that that's really where it confused me.
For sure.
I don't remember which house, but I don't know.
I have a pretty good memory. If you get into this and I'm like, huh, I'll call you out on it. But I don't think, I really don't, I did not see anything about this house name on our list.
Nor did I, and I looked at the list like a million times, okay, trying to double check and then triple check and then quadruple check. So it wasn't long after Hannes and his family, which consisted of his mother, wife, and his three children, moved into the house that the Franklin Castle experienced its first death. Hannes' mother, Wybecka, passed away in 1881, followed shortly by his 15-year-old daughter, Emma. And although Emma died of diabetes, rumors abounded that Hannes was actually to blame for her death. And Emma wasn't the last of the family to die in the house and have it be rumored that Hannes was actually to blame. So Hannes and his wife, Louisa, had six children in total. Emma died at age 15. Dora and August both survived into adulthood. And then three others died in the house shortly after being born. And the death of these children also raised suspicions that perhaps there was more happening in the house than anyone knew. It's said that to distract Louisa from the tragedy of so much loss, Hannes began construction on the house and making it a little bit more elaborate. He added a ballroom that ran the length of the house on the fourth floor, turrets, and even gargoyles to give it that more castle-like look. Mm-hmm. And it was also rumored that he added secret rooms and passageways throughout the house at that time as well. And while some people believe that these were just additions to like the castle vibe, others believe that he actually built them to help conceal his dark deeds.
Yo, though, like if I do housing renovations and I can add secret tunnels and staircases and shit, I'm doing it.
Yeah, 100%. If I ever build a house, it's going to have some secret tunnels and secret rooms and shit.
Secret tunnel through the mountains. Secret tunnel.
Are we going to get flagged for copyright from that?
No, it's just a TikTok reference. Have we been flagged for a copyright for any time I've busted into song yet? No,
we're not big enough yet.
We'll worry about it when it comes down to that. We'll just bleep the whole sections out.
Exactly. New people coming on will be like, what is happening right now? Why is it bleeped out? It's like, you should have been an OG listener. You could have heard Kayla sing. Now you just get a bunch of bleeps.
So, secret tunnels.
Secret tunnels. Emma died. Other children died. People are kind of suspicious of Hannes. So, in 1895, his wife Louisa died of liver failure. However, circumstances surrounding her death, as well as the fact that Hannes remarried shortly after, once again encouraged additional rumors that Hannes had actually murdered her and covered it up as a natural death. In addition to his wife, daughter, and infant children, Hannes was also accused of allegedly hanging his own niece, who was said to be mentally disabled, while in the house, killing a servant girl named Rachel, and murdering his mistress, an illegitimate child. Though these are just rumors, and there isn't really any information that indicates that those people existed, or that he murdered them. So Hannes eventually sold the house in 1896 to the Mulhauser family, and then Hannes himself would die in 1908 following a massive stroke. The house then passed hands several times after this, and it was resold quickly by every family and individual who moved in. They claimed to see a little girl haunting the third floor, a woman in black on the top floor, and a ghostly figure in white on the stairway. And there are rumors of power outages as well as strange noises that would happen in the house. From 1921 to 1968, the house was the home of various German cultural organizations, like the German Socialist Party. And although officially the home was used for meetings and parties and singing clubs, rumors surrounding the organization said that the house was actually being used by German spies during World War I. Years later, a German shortwave radio was allegedly found in the rafters of the attic, proving that there were spies. Mm-hmm. And it was believed that the secret rooms and passageways in the house were used by the Nazis for medical experiments and even a mass murder.
Holy shit.
This house has so many bonkers, like, rumors attached to it. And there's no... I looked at so many sources, and there is just no way to really sift through it to try and figure out what's real and what's not.
Okay.
But Nazis involved.
But Nazis.
Of course. And actually, during Prohibition, the existing tunnels, as well as an allegedly newly constructed tunnel that ran all the way to Lake Erie, was used to smuggle booze into the house for these elaborate German Socialist Party parties. Then, in 1986, the German Socialist Party sold the house to James Romano, and it was around this time that the rumors of the house being haunted really began to circulate. The Romanos had planned to open a restaurant in the house, but soon changed their minds. On the very day that they moved in, Mrs. Romano sent her children upstairs to play, and a little while later, they came back downstairs and asked if they could have a cookie for their new friend, who was a little girl who was upstairs crying. Mrs. Romano followed the children back upstairs, but found no little girl. Throughout their time in the house, the Romanos reported hearing ghostly steps, organ music, and disembodied voices. Apparently, there was organ music happening a lot in the ballroom, and you could hear, I don't know, a party, because it's a ballroom. The Romano children would often speak of the girl who would play with them in the fourth floor ballroom, and other members of the family reported hearing the sound of a child giggling. Many people believe that this is the ghost of Hannes' daughter, Emma, whose spirit is often referred to as the girl in white. And then Mrs. Romano reported that she began feeling the presence of Hannes' wife, Louisa, in the house. Looking for an explanation, the Romanos contacted the Northeast Ohio Psychical Research Society, who sent a team to the house. And if the stories are true, during their investigation, one of the team members became so scared that they ran out of the house screaming. So the Romanos were like, well, that's not cool. And they asked a priest for help to perform an exorcism, which he allegedly refused to do. But he did warn them that there was a bad presence in the house and they should get out.
Okay, so I'm not going to help you, but get the fuck out.
This place is too haunted. Peace out. And you should do the same.
This makes me feel better about the fact that I'm not hella Catholic anymore.
priests. So, eventually the Romanos were over all the ghostly activity and they sold the house in 1974 to Sam Muscatello, who planned to turn the castle into a church. To raise money for the church, Muscatello offered haunted house tours and overnight stays at the castle. Visitors reported seeing a woman in black, who is believed to be Hannes' wife, Louisa, a dark figure that is often seen in the windows. That seems to be her favorite place to be, is looking out windows. In fact, as I was doing the research for this, I found a website that had, it made tiny little figurines of haunted houses that are like 4 inches tall. And it was super cute and it was like $55.
I want one.
And there was like a dark shadowy figure in one of the windows, which would be Hannes' wife, Louisa.
I wonder if we could commission them to make one of Glenn Sheen. That'd be cute. Anyway.
Oh, that would be cute. Oh, maybe. I'll see if I can find it again and I'll send it to you. They reported hearing the sounds of a baby crying, light fixtures that spun around on their own, doors that exploded from their hinges, and cold spots. In fact, the bedroom where Louisa passed away is known as the cold room because it is supposedly 10 to 15 degrees colder than the rest of the house. Always.
That's a significant dip.
That's a significant dip. I would love for this room to be 10 to 15 degrees colder than the rest of the house right now. It's really hot in here. He also liked to invite the media to do walkthroughs of the house, and during one live radio segment, one of the radio hosts claimed that a tape recorder was yanked from his shoulder and hurled down the stairs by an invisible force. Ooh. Also during this time, Muscatello began scouring the house looking for the rumored secret passageways. His first discovery was an old still that seemed to be left over from Prohibition days, and then in 1975, behind a hidden panel in the tower, he found a pile of human bones neatly tucked inside. And while some people believe that these bones, which were allegedly the bones of a child, were proof that Hannes had indeed been involved in murderous activities, others believe that Muscatello had planted the bones himself as a kind of proof of the hauntings, since he was trying to make money giving tours of the haunted house. But either way, the final verdict by authorities was simply that the bones were indeed human and that they were very old.
Okay, but like, Where would he get them?
Right? Yeah. Those who believe that the finding is genuine believe that this is the reason why people will hear a baby crying, because there were babies buried in the walls.
Rough.
Yeah. Eventually, when the Franklin Castle ended up not making as much money as Sam Muscatello had hoped, he sold it. From there, it was passed from person to person, and in early 1985, Michael Davinko, whose stage name was Mickey Deans and was also Judy Garland's fifth and final husband, purchased Franklin Castle and almost immediately started making major renovations on the house. Although I couldn't find a lot of information about the experiences that Michael Davinko had in the house, I did find a newspaper article from around that time that says, "Are the ghosts of Franklin Castle finally happy? Michael Davinko, owner of Cleveland's most famous haunted house, thinks they are. Davinko bought the four-story stone mansion at 4308 Franklin Boulevard for $93,000 in 1985. Since then, he has spent $1 million restoring the house to its original stature and has plans for further improvements. Quote, "We've had a lot of incidents with poltergeists in the house, but they've sort of slowed down their activity," Davinko said. "I believe it's because of what I've done to the house. I guess they have accepted me as Old Man Tiedemann. I've upgraded the house to the way it was, and I'm giving back its dignity."
That's legit. I feel like if you're being respectful of a place, that unless a ghost is like super pissed generally, you're less likely to piss it off.
Oh yeah, especially since, because over the next 10 years after purchasing it, Davinko spent close to $1 million renovating the castle, and he actually went as far as to track down some of the original furnishings. Mm-hmm. I believe he actually found the original key, which still fit the front door.
Nice.
Yeah. But by the end, Davinko put the house up for sale in 1994.
Well, I mean, you can't just hang on to a castle just because. I mean, I could. But it sounds like he could. Gotta make that money.
I think that should be the title of this episode. I mean, you can't always just hang on to a castle just because. The castle was empty from 1994 to 1999 when Michelle Heinberger bought the castle and carriage house using part of her Yahoo stock as one of the company's first employees.
Nice.
She had grown up in Cleveland and had always been fascinated by it since childhood, and she wanted to restore it to its former glory. Unfortunately, that same year, a fire badly damaged the castle, and although she did some pretty extensive repairs, the restorations could not be completed. Then, in 2004, there were rumors that Franklin Castle was going to be completely renovated and turned into the Franklin Castle Club. So, the website said, "The historic Franklin Castle, soon to be the new home to the Franklin Castle Club, a private city club serving lunch and dinners to its members, as well as providing private banquet and meeting facilities, all in the beautifully restored 19th century Victorian mansion. After years of neglect and misfortune, the Second Empire Stone Mansion is being meticulously restored and brought to its original former glory and splendor."
That kind of club. I thought you meant like, we're getting crunk in the club kind of club. And I was like, no, I'd go party in a castle. But no, fuck those kind of club. I can't afford to be in one. So
like a country club.
Yeah, fuck that.
The club's members will have full access to the clubhouse for lunch and dinner, as well as have the opportunity to entertain in one of our private dining rooms, the grand ballroom, or the club lounge. Members will also have the rare opportunity to spend nights in the castle in one of our lavishly furnished guest suites. The castle has captivated Clevelanders for over a century, and now you have the opportunity to be part of the restoration and rebirth of a legend. Contact us today to reserve your place in the Franklin Castle Club, Cleveland's most exciting private club experience. Memberships are limited and only available by contacting us at the club number below. The memberships are affordable and the limited number will undoubtedly be reserved before our opening. We now have less than 30% of our memberships available. Don't miss this rare opportunity to participate in a new era of elegance for Cleveland's most famous home. And then at the bottom of it, it listed a phone number and an email address to contact them about membership. Mm-hmm. So that was in 2004. However, by 2006, the club had been proven to be a sham. There had been no repairs made, and all of the photos on the website were actually just close-up shots from other buildings and websites to make it look like work was being done. There were also no memberships to this fancy club sold, and rumor has it that the house was actually being used to shoot pornography.
I got 3 points. 3 points.
All right.
First of all, by listening to you reading what they were saying about the selling the memberships, I can totally tell that you work in radio. Second thing, I'm super glad it didn't turn into a fucking country club.
Right.
If we have any listeners that are members of country clubs, good for you. But I generally do not like the idea of a country club. It's like, let's all the rich people fucking hang out and fuck the poor people. And then third, I love the idea of sex work being done in a fucking castle. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I wish I could have found more information
on the
about
porn.
That. I found many things that mentioned it, but I was listening to a different podcast that said that it was primarily lesbian porn.
Yeah.
And they went into more details about it, but when I tried to find that information, I couldn't find it.
So
I
you couldn't Googled find what
Franklin
videos?
Castle plus porn.
That should be the title of our episode. I literally Googled Franklin Castle plus porn.
I did. And it brought me things that said they believe it was actually used for pornography, but none of the details that the other podcasts went into. So I was like, I don't know. I'll just use that as a side note and not actually like a bullet point. But yeah. So porn.
I just want to know.
Not a country club.
I want to watch it. I want to know what it was.
Well, at this point, like, the whole house is now apparently just falling down.
Oh.
Which is so confusing because it keeps getting renovated and then it lays, like, dormant for a couple of years and it just gets destroyed and then someone else tries to renovate it and then it gets destroyed. It's kind of sad. Mm. But, man, is that house holding on? Anyway. In 2011, Cleveland.com reported that the Franklin Castle had been purchased and its new owner intended to convert the building into a family home. And then in 2013, ABC News 5 in Cleveland reported that work had begun, though the renovation was far from complete. Then, in 2016, Paranormal Lockdown investigated the Franklin Castle, and it was actually the very first paranormal team to do so.
Oh.
And I watched that one while I was doing dishes today. And they got a couple of things. Like, they saw mist in one of their photos, like, to an extreme where they're like, this has never happened to us during all of our years of research. As well as an EVP of someone saying, get out.
Those are always the creepiest.
In 2017, an author named William G. Krejci wrote the book Haunted Franklin Castle, in which he describes the experiences that people have had in the house. And he said, quote, everything from doors opening and closing, footsteps, things moving around. Some people have reported putting something down and then going back later to find it, and it wouldn't be there. And then the next day, it would be in a different room on a different floor. End quote. Also, Ghost Adventures went there at some point, but I didn't watch it. And, yeah. That's the end of it. I like how I ended it on such like a low meh note. Clearly, I was done writing notes at this point. I believe that Ghost Adventures were the sort of most recent thing that happened. I think they went there potentially in 2018 based upon one of the websites I found and like the ranking of their episodes. But if you go to Amazon to actually watch it, it says that it came out in, like, April of 2020. So, I don't know. Anyway, it's a private residence
Okay. Now.
And last I heard, they were going to try and renovate it so that it could be a multifamily home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have, I think, 3 different units.
Nice.
Which still would be big units. It's like a 20-room house.
But that's just it. Like, they would probably, if they're going to renovate something like a castle, mm-hmm. It's not going to be 3 units of just like your house where it's 2 units. It's going to be 3 luxury units with a gym room, with a like with a public room.
That's
it's going to be a luxury unit thing. Because it's
That's
a fucking
true.
Castle.
It's a fucking castle with gargoyles and turrets. What?
On,
it's like the dream.
On a skeptic scale, I'm going to give this one a 4. I'm debating between a 4.5 or a 5 because there's enough like solid shit in there that I really believe this one.
Yes. I'm going to give it a 4.5 personally.
Okay. Maybe I'm just like feeling extra not skeptic-y today, but I'm buying into it.
I love it. I love it. It, you know, people have been really consistent about what they've seen over the last 50 years.
That's the thing is it's a lot of documented cases and it's the consistency for me.
Yep. Yep. The more consistent something is, the more I'm like, it just seems like.
There's not 800 like, different ghosts and like each person has a tale of a different ghost and we're learning about, right. You know, Betty and Veronica and Archie and Jughead. Like you have your standard set of ghosts. It's not a different tale from each person.
Right. And they all seem to be the original ones.
Exactly.
Like, there doesn't seem to be any new ones. It's just all those people that potentially Hannes had murdered. But who knows? I did find one article where someone was like, everyone thinks that Hannes is so bad. He was such a mean and cruel man, but he wasn't. He was a pillar of the community. He donated all this money and time and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't know. I've looked at a lot of these articles and you're literally the only person that said he was an okay guy.
I think that we are on an upbeat tone for this podcast so far today. So I'd like to keep it on an upbeat with a Reddit story today.
Let's do it. I'm excited.
I think you're going to like this one a lot. I found it. It was from a year ago. This is not one of the ones that I had saved from forever ago. I was honestly looking for new, fun, and spooky stories to read, and this one came up.
Awesome.
This was from the Ghost Stories subreddit, posted a year ago by Augustana88. And the title is literally, "This is a wholesome dog haunting."
Oh, I love dog hauntings.
Augustana writes, "When I was 6 years old, my family bought our first black Labrador. We named her Magic, and we were inseparable.
Oh, Magic.
When I was 18, she passed away from a heart tumor. Oh. I was absolutely devastated, and I had a really hard time getting to sleep afterwards because she slept in my bed with me. A year later, we got another black Labrador. And this is when weird phenomena started happening. It should be noted that the new lab refused to sleep in my room. He didn't even really like going in it at all. He'd always look intently at spots and then quickly leave. I'd bring him on my bed and try to get him to sleep in my room, and he'd jump off right away and cry to be let out. I sleep with my door closed, so I know it wasn't him coming in later. This is relevant. One night, I was tossing and turning, and all of a sudden, it felt as if someone had jumped up on the corner of my bed. It freaked me the hell out. Then, just like she would always do when she was alive, it felt like four paws were moving in a circle, trying to find that sweet spot, before the covers would just gently press down at my feet.
Oh, Magic.
This happened to me every night for weeks. I sort of felt like I was going insane, but one night it was really annoying me because it woke me up, so I said out loud, 'Magic, go bug Mom.' I was half joking to myself because I didn't actually fully believe it was her. But the next morning, right, over breakfast, my mom looks at me and says, 'The strangest thing happened to me last night. I swear it felt like Magic jumped on my bed, found a comfy spot, and laid down.'"
'Cause she did.
I had never told my mom that I thought Magic was jumping on my bed every night because I thought I was insane. But my mouth dropped open when she said this. I told her how it was happening to me and that I had sent Magic to bother her that night. We cried because we didn't want Magic to think we replaced her. Later that week, it just stopped all of a sudden, and I told my mom that I hadn't felt Magic jump on my bed in the last few days. My mom told me that when I wasn't home, she went up to my room and told Magic that we loved her, and we will never forget her, and that she could never be replaced, and it's okay for her to rest now. Ever since then, my new Labrador has slept in my room every night. I like to think that Magic gave him permission. My mom and I still tell people the story. We have no explanation for it, and we like to believe she came back to spend just a bit more time with us and show the new pup how to be the goodest boy."
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the first time I read this, I started like tearing up, and I was like, I need to read this on the podcast. It's so cute.
That was beautiful, and I like that its name was Magic.
Magic is the goodest boy.
The goodest boy.
And
wait, isn't Magic a girl?
I they did not specify.
Oh, okay.
And if Augustana is hearing this ever, I'm happy you have two of the goodest boy dogs.
Yeah. That was adorable. I hope that...
Oh, wait. Magic was a girl. Never mind. I just read some of the pronouns. You're right. I'm happy. I'm happy that both of the dogs are so good, and I'm it's so cute.
That was a good story.
If you have a story you would like to share, because on top of reading Reddit stories, we also love to read listener stories. It's our favorite. You can send us listener stories to leftofskeptic@gmail.com or visit our website, leftofskeptic.com, and click the listener stories tab. You can choose to remain anonymous or include your name. Either way, we just ask that you please include your pronouns. Additionally, we are trying to grow our podcast base. So if you have a particularly good story that you love and want to share it with a friend, we would greatly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Left of Skeptic or Left of Skeptic Podcast on Facebook.
Social media. I'm getting better at social media, y'all. I just found a new app to use. Nice. I'm remembering to post the content that I tell y'all I'm going to post. And this week, I'm updating the website. I'm going to be on it.
Damn. Well, I've got all the information to add about my stories. I just will also do that, I swear.
We're living the dream. We're living the podcasty dream, and we want to thank you all for coming with us and joining us for our podcasty dream on this spooky Wednesday. We love you very much. Yes. Thank you for your support.
Happy spooky Wednesday.
Happy spooky Wednesday.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Left of Skeptic podcast is written and hosted by Kayla Moria and Brittany Lind. This week's episode is edited by me, Brittany Lind. The Left of Skeptic music is by Dave Melling and Emily Havoc, and our artwork is by Al LeBlanc. Okay, bye!